Well, hello and welcome to another episode of In Your Field. Now, I'm really excited because we're actually on location at the Wensleydale Experience for our podcast today, learning about the creation, the ups and downs of running a yurt business, if you're watching on film, but also you're going to learn about my adventure with Oreo the Goat. A refreshing change for the In Your Field podcast. We're actually sat out on a fabulous location with Stephanie and Tim from the Wensleydale Experience. It's so good to be outdoors, isn't it? And actually be able to speak to people in person. So welcome and thank you for being a part of the podcast.
Well, thank you.
Obviously, we can see where we are. People on the podcast won't be able to see. So just explain whereabouts in the country we are. And, you know, we're sat outside a wonderful yurt and what your business is.
Yeah.
Well, we're in Wensleydale, as the name gives it away a little bit. So we're one of the northern dales of the Yorkshire Dales National Park. We're in North Yorkshire, towards the top end of North Yorkshire. We're about 25 minutes from the A1. So if you're going up the A1,
come off at Beedale,
I'm not sure what junction it is, 51? And then we're about 25 minutes from there.
So I can never remember junctions.
No, me neither. Right. It's one where the road splits into three and you go that. But yeah, we're in a nice, lovely part of the area, but we're not a million miles away. We are close enough to get here. From a lot of the conurbations in the north of England, and we get a lot of visitors from there, and we get a good few visitors from further afield as well.
Yeah, so to answer your question more literally, we're sat on the decking of our oak yurt, so we're an integrative immersive experience of Wensleydale, hence the name, the Wensleydale Experience. So we have six yurts on site here. We have a temple folly that's an 18th century converted banqueting hut, like little hall where they go in the middle of their shoots to have their whiskey
and hunts,
sustenance,
yeah.
Wouldn't they?
Sounds fabulous.
And then we do farm tours and farm experiences on site as well. And then we try to bring in lots of other local businesses into, you know, our guest experience of Wensleydale. So we've got on site a farm shop and cafe, and then the Healing Collective, which is like sort of massages, Indian head massages, Reiki, all sorts of different holistic therapies that people can have them in their yurts, or they can go to the little sort of office that they have on site here. So yeah, we're just all about sort of eco-friendliness, customer experience. That's what's in
experience,
the nutshell, isn't it, really?
Is the experience what Wensleydale's got to offer.
We've had a good walk around the yurts, you know, after we've now been on our farm experience and recaptured the goat and put him back. Oreo decided he wanted to take a little wander on our farm walk. But when we've been, I mean, there's outdoor hot tubs, you've got barbecue. I mean, it's completely different to what people might, but at the same time, glamping's become a bit of a thing across the country these days, isn't it?
Glamping's massive at the moment.
It is big, and there's such a vast range of different options if you want to go glamping. Mm. And you can literally, from going in a converted school bus or whatever, a converted lorry, to going in a pod, which is just literally a structure with a carpet in, and that's all you've got to work from. Everybody's different, yeah. And we're doing what we're doing, and it's what we're doing, and it works for us and for our guests.
I suppose some people go completely off-grid then, don't they, in terms of they don't have any electric or Wi-Fi, whereas, I mean, here you've got power, etc.
Well, no. So actually, we've got the similar sort of very rural, off-the-grid ethos, and the yurts do have solar power, so there's a USB charger, so you can get hair dryers, I believe, with the USB port, but they're quite rare. So there's no Wi-Fi on site, there's solar power with a USB charger, but there's no 3-pin sockets, there's no real electricity. The fairy lights you can sort of see in the yurt behind you are all
there was I, assuming that you got, and that is because I've seen the lights and seen everything in there, so I've assumed that there's power, but there isn't.
We've looked at different things and we've set these up ourselves. They are, because they are sort of just normal lights that you might have in your kitchen, but they're actually 12 volt, which is it's 12 volt system, and we've got it put it all together and it works for us.
So do you ever have that, and this is sound a bit daft, this is me usual performance, but do people turn up thinking that there would be power?
I think more people turn up thinking surprised that they've got some sort of power.
Right, okay. So they are, I mean, obviously you have to describe what it is that people are coming to, but I could almost imagine, especially some of my friends, booking something and just assuming that, you know, there would be some kind of power provision.
We did have a party in a couple of weekends ago, and this late girl in the party offered me £100 if she could dry her hair both mornings. And she was quite happy to give me £100. I didn't take it. I let her dry her hair one morning. I wasn't here the next morning. She's quite happy. I don't know. We've had people sat with the cars running and plugging hair strainers in the car.
But that is what we want to sort of really cultivate, though, this feeling of switching off and coming away from it all. And you've got your lovely yurt, and it's completely self-contained, and you've got your own private bathroom, hot tub, yurt. And if you don't want to go out and see anybody, you don't have to. You know, we get food boxes from the cafe that can be delivered to the yurt. So, yeah, really, if you want to come away from it all. Absolutely, yeah.
But there is enough Wi-Fi. There is enough, not Wi-Fi, there is enough mobile data.
Yeah.
We had families watching the football on the iPads.
Yeah.
And there was enough data for that.
Yeah.
But if you don't want to, you don't have to have it. It's not there. It's just, we need to switch off as a society. We just need to get away from it all.
Mm.
4 and 5G now is so powerful that you can still use it pretty much wherever you are.
Absolutely,
you really.
Yeah.
So winding back then to the early days of the Wensleydale experience, I mean, how did it happen initially?
I suppose it started off, we're always looking to diversify, looking for different income streams.
Because we're on an estate, aren't we?
We are on an estate. We are on an estate. And Ollie, whose parents own the estate, we chatted together. He's very much very passionate about the estate. Mm. And not to take it for granted, he was more based on getting people to share what we've got here.
Yeah.
We have this amazing place that we live in, and it's amazing. We've got to be able to afford to live in here, but it's amazing. And we want to share it with other people. The place is unique. The views are unique. And if we can just share that with other people, and while they're obviously people are paying to come and stay here, and that keeps everything else rolling round, and it's very much part of the rural economy, keeping other local shops, local businesses going, local cafes, restaurants and pubs. We send our guests to different places to eat, so they do well. It's really getting everybody working together and getting people who aren't as fortunate to live in such a nice place to be able to experience that.
And it's a very symbiotic relationship, really, with the other businesses on site. You know, we're sort of bringing people in for the amazing views and things, and then they're also going and having delicious meals in the cafe and all these different things. And we quite often will find people asking us for recommendations about where to go, because obviously we live here and we know.
Yeah.
You know, there's always, you know, really good places and some not so good places. So
I mean, it's a great example, really, isn't it? Because most, you know, you speak to a lot of people that are diversifying, and their land, their owners that are looking to diversify. Where in this instance, it's more of a landlord-tenant relationship. But you do need that buy-in from them and that desire and want to see successful businesses like this thrive in a location like this.
The estate is multifaceted. We are very much part of the estate, though. We are a piece of the estate, and more a very important part. You know, obviously it's, you know, quite an important part of the estate, and we do all work together to that end. And it's just a case of keeping the estate working as a thing.
Because the Wensleydale experience without the rest of the pieces of the estate wouldn't be as amazing as it is today. You know, without the farm and the animals, wouldn't be able to sort of integrate the stay
cafe
with the animals, and the animals with the meat that they're eating in the cafe. And it's all very integrated, and that's how we sort of designed it.
It works as a one.
Seems to work really well, yeah.
Did it take us to, I mean, we've just been on a farm walk, but in terms of what you experience on the farm walk, I mean, we've got sheep. And do you have other sheep here, or is it?
We have estates. So we farm so much in-house with the estate owners part of the home farm. And then other farmers rent land and farms off the estate. No, it's only a small estate, but land and farms off the estate. Now, the farmer in the village, we work very closely with him. So quite often I'll be part of the farm tours. We'll be looking at his animals as well as ours. They realise that people need to learn about farm animals. They realise that people need to know what's going on. So they're really actually happy for us to use their animals as part of that thing.
I mean, you've seen in a lot of farm tours, haven't you, that people really have no idea where the food in the supermarket comes from. And it's a really important part of sort of educating people about that. And yeah, sort of seeing the animals in the field and translating that into, oh, this is actually what is on my plate now, is a really important part of what we do, I think, educating people.
And we do, I mean, we are a farm, we're not a zoo. And I really, yeah, some animals that we're probably not going to eat, such as the goat, but we are very much a farm.
They might eat
them to make it. The last one I wanted a curry.
Curried goat.
The last time we had one to sell, I wanted a curry night and I was outvoted. But anyway,
Oreo was
on his brother. Now but we are a farm. So everything we do, we are doing that to produce meat. And I generally ask people if they eat meat. Sometimes we get vegetarians, some people get vegans. And it's all relevant. And I think it's really important that we had a lady on a couple of days ago and she was a vegetarian, but she was considering veganism. And I think it's really important that you can go and you can show people what actually does go on. And there's so much bad press in agriculture. So many people have got their own agendas about their own theories about what is going on. But their own theories are really biased. And we wanted just to put that into perspective, saying this is how things happen. And yet, some things might not be perfect. But generally, the stuff we do in Britain is as good as it gets.
Yeah, I mean the roots are in education, and I've always believed that. I don't ever have any issue with what diet anybody chooses to follow, as long as it's done on a basis of educating themselves into why and what they're doing it for, whether or not they're doing it for a health benefit or whether they're doing it because of a preference, etc. I think as long as it comes from a place of understanding and education, it's not an issue. It's when it's been formed off the back of bad press and misinformation. Mm. I think that's when we've got a real challenge in front of us, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, there's no doubt that there are some areas that would be ideally done in a different way, like factory farming, or you know, where the birds are in a really high density, and it's not good for their quality of life, is it? But
no.
I mean, what we're trying to do here is only on a very small scale, but to do things sort of with the pigs that live outside instead of being in the shed all the time. We do very small batch litters, don't we? So we because they're rare breeds, they have less piglets anyway than a commercial breed would have. So we take those very small litters, we rear them really carefully in the wood and partially in the stables, and sort of make sausages out of them. And it's that really sort of, it's the batch control, I think. The fact that we're doing it in a really low intensity way, that I think really appeals to people.
It does appeal to people, but we've got to also understand that the supermarkets are in that position now where they have the monopoly on virtually everything.
But there are still independent butchers.
But the supermarkets have that monopoly, and everybody now has got used to be able to walk into a supermarket and get whatever joint, whatever veg, whatever fruit, whatever time of year they want. And that's got to come from somewhere.
Mm.
So we talk about that. We talk about intensive farming. We talk about, we don't have any arable farming around here. It's not fit, but we do talk about arable farming as part of the farm tour and farm experiences.
We have a bit of a job on some of these hills.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's I could talk all day. But yeah, no, but we really are. We're not just talking about the farming that we have. This is a snippet of agriculture as it goes along. But we have the knowledge behind us to talk about it in more detail and talk about what might happen. You know, it's really important. We have the calf that we saw earlier in the field there. We'll keep him while he's about 10 months old, and then somebody from York might come and buy him, because in York they have cereals that they've grown themselves, they have straw that they've grown themselves, and they'll feed that to that calf to get it fat.
Yeah.
Up here, everything we fed and bedded it on has got to come back of a lorry. So it costs so much more. One trip from Leyburn to York, done. And that's a really big part of what we do here is actually really incorporated in what they do there, in what other farmers do in other areas. It all works together as one thing.
It's collaborative working.
Yeah. And again, with the sheep, we're rearing mule gimmers here that go to Hawes, and they go from Hawes. There's some sheep went last year from this farm to 10 miles from the south coast of England. They literally go all over the world, all over the country. Because we're producing such a fantastic animal in the North Country mule, the whole country wants a little bit, and they go all over the place. So it's not just, we're not just in this insular little farm, on this insular little backwater, we are actually part of the mainstay of producing meat all over the country.
And we do also try to optimise what we've got as well, don't we? Like the higher reaches of the estate, where it is sort of not good quality grazing land, it's more sort of like the heathers and the really scrubby land, but we can graze Highland cows on them, not at a very high density, but our Highland herd will go up there to sort of grow a little bit, won't they? And maybe when they're sort of a calf to probably 1 year old, sort of that.
When they've
kind
been
of
weaned
age.
until they're fat, really, and they stay up there. And the Highlands are a big part of the farm experience. People like Highland cattle.
Yeah, so the farm experience is a half day, isn't it? Yeah. The farm tour is about an hour, but the farm experience, they really get to interact more with the animals, don't they? Sort of feeding them and...
And part of the Highlands are right up there, so we can go up there in the truck. And just driving up there, it's going places where you're not really able to walk, and they're getting taken there, and you can look at different things. Walls, we've got 93 miles of dry stone wall on the farm.
Yeah, I was going to pick up on that actually, because sat here, people that are listening are not necessarily going to appreciate around us that you only have to look around to know that even though we're only sort of 25 minutes from the, you feel immersed in North Yorkshire,
absolutely.
Because we're surrounded by dry stone walls. You've got the landscape, the hills, the hilly and holly fields. You feel like you're in North York, and it's that immersive feeling, and that's
absolutely.
What you want to get across to people, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Well, you can't escape that accent anyway, Tim.
It's not a North Yorkshire accent, though.
How do we make it more North Yorkshire?
I don't know. I don't have an accent.
He said the other day, I aren't bothered. So that's pretty Yorkshire.
No.
He is doing all right with the Yorkshire.
No, I'm actually South Yorkshire, but he's travelled around a little bit. But yeah.
I mean, one of the things I noticed, we've talked about the walls and the landscape around here. I mean, you've done quite a bit around the yurts themselves with allowing that to be as natural as possible as well. I mean, sometimes you go to some of these places, we're very, very manufactured, very commercial or mown, but it's great here to see the long grasses, the tussocky grass, enough for the the beetles, the insect, the bumblebees, the and all of that kind of thing. Is that something that you were quite keen on?
Absolutely. I mean, we've planted 250 trees within the yurt. So, I mean, the yurt wood itself is an ancient wood. We have taken some trees out to make space for the yurts, but like I said, we've planted at least 250 trees in the yurt site itself. A lot of the timber we stood on now is all homegrown timber. Any projects we do on the estate, wherever possible, we use homegrown timber.
All the hot tubs are fed by wood from the estate.
Yeah, all the wood we burn.
You know, the log burners in the yurts are all the same thing.
Constantly chopping wood then, are you?
Yeah, but every February...
Well, it's a cycle though, because it's planting and chopping,
yeah,
isn't it?
Between...
So you're locking that carbon back that you're releasing.
Yeah.
Every February we plant between 3,000 and 6,000 trees. Regardless, so that's irrespective of anything else, we're there planting these 3 to 6,000 trees every February and up and down different little pockets of the farm. Yeah, we take wood out, but we're taking wood out to use. It's managing that woodland and it's really important. I mean, the cafe on site, the offices on site, they're all heated by a biomass boiler which burns wood off the estate. The Steph says all the wood that we burn on site, so the hot tubs and the log burners and the fire pits, all homegrown wood.
Self-sustaining,
yeah, absolutely.
And the rewilding was very deliberate as well. It came up on an Archer storyline not too long ago, and we were like, yes, we're on the Archers essentially. But it's not to everybody's taste. We have had one or two guests, not very often, just now and again, say it would have been nice if it could have been trimmed and maintained, but that's not what we're about. No. We're about, letting nature thrive and the yurts being part of that and integrated in that, not trying to fight nature.
Well,
absolutely,
yeah. I mean,
people see long grass and think that's actually not been maintained, whereas I actually see that as, a haven for nature and wildlife.
We do have the little bit mown, as we saw on the front there. We keep that nice and tidy so that children can have a run round and adults sometimes.
So I bet you drive. I bet you actually drive the local sheep a bit bonkers then, do you? Because I bet half of the birds want to.
Well, yeah, we all have a small crossover when it gets to that time of year, so we try and keep the nose down. But yeah.
Yeah, because the yurt season runs from April to October, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so a few
yeah,
weeks
we're pretty much closed by the time they're
and then
they're
coming
down,
out. Away, but yeah.
So you do have a closed season.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
To be fair, that's the planning restrictions. We've been in a national park. Planning is can be a nightmare. We only have planning till the end of October, and we start again in April, beginning of April. But to be quite honest, it's not a bad thing. Right. Last year with COVID, we were able to keep open a little bit longer. We stayed open, I think, 10 days into November, whatever it was, and then got shut down with to refund no end of money back to people who rightly didn't want us to keep the money over Christmas. I could totally understand that. And then we'd still got some bookings up to Christmas. So then after we'd been locked down for a month, we had to open back up again. And the yurts are cold, you're doing a lot more logs.
Yeah, I think really we'd have to insulate the walls with like, because in the Mongolian desert where they actually use these yurts, it's a totally authentic design yurt. The guy that makes them actually spent time in Mongolia to learn the design. Okay. And in there, they put all sort of little fleeces and felts in the walls to insulate it. So it's fine if you get the log burner stove going really well. It's okay, but it's not really sustainable through winter.
And the
solar, solar power as well.
Yeah. A bit cooler in the morning.
Yeah.
The showers are all aren't frostproof. You know, it's not really. Yeah. And the solar panels are great now when you've got really long days and short nights. But when you get to short days and long nights, yeah. then you use a lot more power and they don't last as long.
Mm.
So absolutely. We're quite happy. Go till end of October. Yeah. They all come down, which is a bit of a challenge, but. They're amazing. It's a work of art in itself.
So you have to take it all down as well.
It's a work of art in itself, though. I mean, they are so amazing. I just love taking them down. I love putting them up and taking them down. How everything fits
strange
together.
Strange man.
Well, yeah, we knew that already, though, didn't we? To be fair. But they are amazing. I when we've bought new, just a new yurt, it's just awesome.
So it's like that thing that those people that sit there with a new book and get the pages and have to smell it because it's like the new print on pages and things like that.
I tell you what, if you said to me next year you can have a new yurt or a new car, it'd have to be a new yurt.
Forget new car smell, you like new yurt smell.
So
when we decided to have yurts, we scoured the country up and down and we found Paul King.
Yeah, from Woodland Yurts.
From Woodland Yurts in Bristol, just outside Bristol. And we decided that he was really the man to build our yurts. He's lived in yurts in Spain and Mongolia. He's written books about them. And we thought this is it. This is the place to go. So we spoke to him at length on... did we speak on Zoom back in then?
I'm not sure.
We spoke to him at length on a conference call and established what we wanted. And then when it came to actually... get the yurts, we drove down to Bristol, we put one up in his workshop, he showed us how to put it up, and then we put his all back at van and came home and away we went. We've not looked back.
And he's a totally independent, you know, craftsman, isn't he?
Yeah,
he does everything in house. His wife sews the canvas, these canvas sheets, you can see all her sewing down there. And he sort of makes all the wooden struts himself by hand. It is a work of art, really.
Did it take a lot of space up storage wise then?
Yeah. Quite a bit, to be honest, yeah. You would get a bit back of a... You'd get one in a... I'm going to say an Escort. You don't have Escort estates now, do you? Like a family sort of car, you'd get one in a... You know, you'd quite easily get one in a family car. The length's a problem, but that sort of space.
Right.
You end up with two big bags. The sides go in a bag and the roof goes in a bag. Yeah. The door's quite
and
a big
six
thing.
Doors.
How long does it take then to take put one up and take one down?
If we set off with the right people helping, we could have one up in a... 2.5 hours?
Yeah, 2 hours, something like that.
It takes quite a bit more to fit them out, to put the kitchen units in the bed.
I suppose in some ways it does allow you to maintain the floor and the decking and everything through the winter.
The floors come into four. The floors are split into four, if you can see. Mm. We take those inside, we stand them up, and then throughout, well, after Christmas, I'll start and I sand them all down and varnish them all. I have a pile of them and I move them around, so I do two at once and then move them across and do two more.
No, it's just getting attacked by wasps.
You're
right.
Run away!
That's our only wasp. We've never seen a wasp here before.
Yeah, we get a lot of bees, don't we?
Well, I would be. It would be difficult that whilst I'm doing a podcast that one would find me, so it's all fine.
Yeah, so yeah, you're right, it gives you a chance to take them down. Last year we left three of them up when we stayed open for COVID and we decided that we'd leave them up the earliest we could really take them down was Christmas, and we're opening again in April, so we left them up, and they've not really benefited from being left up.
Right.
We're not doing it again.
No, you see, in the sort of traditional way that a yurt's used, it's moved for the seasons as the nomadic tribes move around to better weather areas as winter comes in. They'll take the yurts with them, so they never get exposed to that really bad weather.
They don't look their best.
They're getting there. One of them, I think, we have to try and wash. So I'm not exactly sure how we're going to go on with that. But,
Do you think you'll enjoy washing one as much as you?
No, I'm not going to wash it. No, I'm hoping as... the laundry, Brompton Laundry, we use it again, are a local company. They do all our laundry we hire their bedding. They actually have a marquee company.
Right.
And I'm going to approach them and see if they'll watch it.
I'm
not sure whether that'll work or not. I don't know whether they'll be up for it or not.
So in terms of your biggest challenges then, because I mean, when you first set this up, I mean, I suppose when you're inviting first guests and everything, it's a bit nerve-wracking, isn't it? People on their first experiences and wanting to make sure everything goes right. But I mean, in terms of challenges, if you were talking to somebody who was thinking about doing something similar, they've got a part of the farm or the estate, what would you say to them?
Don't do it anywhere near us, for a start.
You see, you can definitely tell you're in Yorkshire because people are just definitely upfront with exactly what they want to say.
No, I think that the biggest thing is...
Don't you dare put
one out. To be quite honest, we're doing what we do, and yeah, I'm not too worried about competition in that state. Yeah. But I think that we get good yurts. Get good yurts or good accommodation, whether it's yurts or... anything else, get good yurts.
Maybe start small and see how, like, iron out all the issues with one if it's a new design, and
we've
then
certainly changed
expand
our,
from there, I think.
Our ways, I mean, the newer yurts, this one and Beach is different again, how we've laid it out. Mm. Our yurts are all more or less the same inside. We have tweaked and tweaked them a little bit, but go steadily.
Yeah. Even the types of hot tubs that we're buying latterly to replace, you know, the old ones have changed in the design just because we've sort of understood how they work better. So now we have an external burner rather than internal burner. Yeah. So it just gives people a lot more flexibility sitting in the hot tub. It gets a lot warmer, a lot faster.
There are a whole
lots of little tiny tweaks that we've made as we've progressed, I think. And but still are still making. We don't think we know it all by any means.
We have a massive, massive, massive thing about customer service, and we want to be approachable. We want seen on site, so that when people come, we show everybody around, and we show everybody around all the little bits that aren't that obvious. We point that out to people, which works a lot better because we don't get people breaking things. We don't get people ringing up with silly questions because they can't work something because we've told them already how it works.
Well, they're not silly. They're not silly. They're obvious to us because we've done it 1,000 times. But for an outside person coming in, they're actually not silly.
But we just be there and be up front with, and be open with people and don't get me wrong, anybody is as a business and things don't go right. Things go wrong, don't they? Mm. And whatever you do, things go wrong and you can't help things going wrong. But when things do go wrong, be there on site and sort it out.
Yeah.
And
it's how you respond to the issues.
And the response to issues
that
arise. Yeah, I mean, we've been very fortunate in not having that many. Mm. But
and it is putting yourself in their position as well, you know, and if something goes wrong, you know, your heart goes out to them and you want to fix it as much as you possibly can so they get back on track and have a wonderful stay with us.
But we're very fortunate with the site. It's an amazing site.
I guess a lot of it can be down to your advertising and your marketing, isn't it? If people know what to expect, then they're almost pre-prepared, aren't they?
Yeah, we've looked into, we do advertise on a few websites. We have used a booking agent before. We've now sort of stepped away from the booking agent. We've got a reasonable presence online, social media.
I love how he says reasonable when I'm the person that does the social media. I would have said fantastic myself.
Reasonably amazing.
what an outrage.
But we have got that. We've got a good website. We keep up to date with the website. And I think sort of paper advertising is probably gone and done, and nobody, you know, I don't think we've anything to gain from that. But our biggest thing, without a shadow of a doubt, is word of mouth.
Yeah.
Get people to enjoy it. Get people to enjoy it. Tell their friends. Spread the word around. And come back. Mm. You know, we have people coming back with a guy and his wife staying in there a couple of weeks last week. And I think this was their fourth visit.
Yeah.
We get a lady who came on a hen night when we first opened up, and she's come on a anniversary every year since.
We had hens here.
We have had some hen nights here.
Are you mad?
Well, you know what? So far, we've done all right.
I was going to say, hens is a bit different to stags, isn't it?
Well, you know what? We had a stag night once, and then with two groups of girls, and the groups of girls, there were just 2 years with one group of girls in 2 years. And I don't think they were particularly, they weren't a hen night or anything, but they left to the right state.
Right.
And the stags walked down and they went, oh, I'm really sorry, we've broken a plate. And the yurt was immaculate, so I left everything else. So
yeah.
we don't advertise for hen parties, but we have had them, and so far everyone's been really...
We don't very often, do we?
I think the people, if you're going to go to Magaluf for a hen party, you're not going to come here, are you? You know, those sort of people, and if you're sort of stereotype hen parties, which you shouldn't.
I mean, would you say that, I mean, because you're based here as well, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, full-time based here. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, a lifestyle as much as it is a job.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you've got to love it, haven't you? You've got to love what you do because, you know, it's long hours, you know, quite an extended period over when you would ordinarily go away on holiday. You're always going to be working. I mean, is it tough? Do you get those days or...?
Absolutely. You know, yeah, absolutely we do. And yeah, there's a lot of things that are out of our control as well. There are a lot of things in the setup of the estate, the wider estate, that are not in my control, not in our control. And sometimes, yeah, you do have your good days and your bad days.
Mm.
But generally, the bad days are over, and you wake up next morning and you have a good day.
Yeah.
And
I mean, we're, as well as being in the business together, we're dating. So we're. I can honestly say, like, Tim is like, he loves his job. He's super passionate about it, and it. You know, sometimes something goes wrong and he'll get down like any of us do. But at the end of the day, he loves what he does. And I think that's why the customers respond so well to him, because it shines through when he's interacting with them. He loves people. I'm a hermit. He loves people. And he that just comes through, I think. And people respond to that warmth, and it's reflected in reviews and people coming back year on year. And
Would you change anything, though? Would you change... I mean, it's always a difficult thing to say, because I never like to say that I'd change anything, because I think you're on the journey that you're on, and I think things happen for a reason. But would you, in terms of when you look at it from a business point of view, are there things that you wish you'd have done slightly differently?
Probably done it a few years before.
Yeah, got into it earlier.
Yeah, I think we could have got into it a few years before. Yeah.
Started earlier, so that's more of it. Is that a confidence thing, do you think?
Probably so, yeah, because just that idea of, I mean,
it's also, you know, thinking about it just never came up as a way to diversify the estate, because it wasn't really a thing. Glamping's only quite a new approach to holidaying, isn't it? And I think we did sort of activate the plan quite early, but it's still an emerging, evolving field, glamping, I think. And we're enjoying the journey, certainly.
Absolutely,
aren't we?
Yeah. And I think we've learnt a lot. We've learnt a lot around, like we spoke about, the booking agents. But actually, I think when you're first starting off and you've got 4 years to let, having somebody else selling your bookings is probably not a bad thing. But it's
definitely
nice to be in that position where hopefully we can carry on ourselves without having that external.
Yeah, I mean, there is an unknown about, you know, what's going to happen as COVID hopefully filters away a little bit and sort of leaches out of society, and, you know, how people's holidaying patterns are going to change. But I think, well, I genuinely do think, and I hope as well, that people will have had this almost like a forced chance to come on more UK-centric trips. And I think they've mostly enjoyed what they've seen here. And I think it'll possibly revert to more of a hybrid model where it's the UK and
we talked about that a little bit earlier, didn't we, when we were doing the farm tour, and I think as much as a lot of people are holidaying in the UK this year, but I think by being forced into having a look at what's around them, they now know what's available, and I think it will be incorporated probably into sort of additional holidays with any luck, or even people switching completely.
Yeah,
I think people will. I think people used to go literally just jump on a plane every time and didn't even give it a second thought. Will now have a thought about it, and maybe one in three stay in the UK, or maybe all the way around, and one in three go abroad. But when you talk to a lot of our guests over the last, well, this year and last, have said, yeah, we'd normally go abroad, but now we'd consider coming back here. And a vast amount of people, whether it's just lip service, but the vast amount of people that leave and say we're coming back is phenomenal. A lot do.
So what's in the future then, both
well,
of you?
Well, you see, we
talk about growing, and we've got our 6 years now, and as we spoke about earlier, if we had 10 years, we couldn't offer the same standard of service without setting more people on, employing people, and you've got to employ people that are the right people, have got the right time available. And
it's not even about the service as well, that's part of it, but it's the experience as well.
And it's seasonal, nobody wants to come and work. I'm fortunate enough to get other work on the estate through the rest of the year. But if you're coming to a work full time for 7 months a year and then you're out of work for 3 months, 4 months, it's not much good. But there is a possibility we may look at some point in the future in a seventh year, but that will be it for here. We've got another self-catering. We have the Temple Folly, which is our self-catering unit, which is about a mile that way. We have a little barn down there. It's currently being done up by the estate to be a self-catering let, which we're going to be managing.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of other barns. We've got 60-odd barns here spread around.
That goes with this landscape,
yeah,
doesn't it,
landscape.
Really? I mean, you only have to drive down on the way here and you'll see beautiful
lots
buildings that are disused that could all be, you know...
So whether in the future, and it won't be in the short future, but in the medium-term future, one or two more of those will get converted and then hopefully we'll be managed.
It'll be quite organic, though,
can't it?
Because
yeah.
And that's a more year-round thing.
I don't think it's a time to grow massively because we don't know what's going to be around the corner.
No.
COVID might clear away and everybody might go abroad. COVID might not clear away, heaven forbid.
Yeah.
And who knows? You know, we don't know. So just at the minute... The barn on there has been a long-term project and that's toddling along nicely. But we just need to get through this year and possibly next and then reevaluate where we're at.
There's always ways to, I think whenever you're looking at anything like what you've got here, there's always ways to improve and offer more and do things. And, you know, there's always ways to sort of take stock, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I think that's the one thing. I'm having a lot of conversations with businesses at the moment that are considering diversification and with the fallout from the basic payment scheme and Elms, not quite knowing what to do. And the first thing I've told them to do is to just take stock of what it is that you've already
Absolutely.
Got and make sure that you are going in the right direction.
Yeah.
And actually, is more better? Or does more make you a busy fool because actually you've got the right work? I think work-life balance during COVID has never been further to the fore.
I mean, we are busy here. We are busy when it's busy. But then we get the time off in winter. And
one of the other things we'd love to do, I think, we did a little bit of it. We did a little cheeky little BBC segment filming where a school came as like part of their curriculum to learn about countryside and where food comes from and all different things like that, and we loved having those children on site and educating them about and interacting with them about things. And we're just in a funny position here really because we're a little bit too far from major places like York, Leeds for school children to comfortably travel here, but we would love to get into that part more. I think
we'll have to put you in touch with one of our other podcasters, John from the Great Outdoors. Who
we listened to that one
did
actually.
You?
Yeah, it was awesome. That was
so
awesome.
It's what he special. I think it's all that. It's just about giving back, isn't it? And it's like where the food comes from. You know, that side of things because I think it is what's so important, and I think people are just really a lot more connected with it at the moment.
I mean, we do the farm tours. Possibly about 60% of the people that come on our farm tours are yurt guests. We also do the farm experience, which is a half a day experience, and I would think maybe 10% of our guests, 10% of the farm experience guests are yurt guests as well. But the farm experience we're definitely building on year on year.
With a different audience.
And
interacting and connecting with different tour providers who want to come and experience Wensleydale. So we just had one of those a few weeks ago,
well,
didn't
we? We're tagging in with different people who we're not... They're bringing people to us.
Because they like what we're offering and we like what they're offering. So it's the perfect fit,
that,
really.
That works well for us as well. And we can do bespoke. We can do whatever people want. If somebody wants to come and spend 3.5 hours looking at Highland Cow, they can come and spend 3.5 hours looking at Highland Cow. And it does happen.
Can I come and spend 3.5 hours with Oreo, you know, just as when I want to go on escape? That's all I needed to know. That's all I needed to know. Look, we have been done the podcast today, but we have really enjoyed your hospitality, and thank you so much for accommodating us today. We've actually also recorded the North regionals, and you've helped with all of that. As a company, you absolutely delighted us last year with your reaction video, and I think when you won the Royal Business Award last year. And for the benefit of everybody listening to the podcast, we'll try and post a link to that if we can find it. But thank you so much for today, and for talking to us and introducing us to all the farm animals. We do really appreciate it.
Fantastic. It's been a real pleasure having you here.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care, both of you, and all the best for the future.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for the In Your Field podcast. Now make sure you don't miss an episode by subscribing either via Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast from.